Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The Science of Iowa. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending time with us on this final full weekend in January. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Capturing the Iowa caucuses isn't necessarily just about the most votes. There's a real science behind winning such a unique process. We'll explore it.
The college class at Emory University turning up interesting history from the Jim Crow era.
On the football front, a look at what NFL stadiums do for home values and how it's easier than ever to make the Pro Bowl.
And Fox is airing Grease live on Sunday with a live studio audience that'll be visible on TV.
What the television audience will see is not only the actors taking place and singing, you know, these lovable kind of high school cliques at Rideau High, right? But you will also see parts of the audience which will be seated within the set so that you can see their reactions.
Wall Street Journal reporter Pia Catton on what's unique about Grease Live on Sunday and, of course, what could go wrong. She's here later in the hour. The Iowa caucuses are a political event like no other. For one, it's extremely local. Secondly, it's public. The Hawkeye State officially kicks off voting season this Monday to start the week. And Bloomberg reporter Stephen Yacino says there's a real science to winning there. Steve, what should we know?
So the Iowa caucuses are something that I think a lot of the country don't quite understand, even though they're immensely important to the American political process. It's really, on its face, a very simple thing. Neighbors gather in local precincts, and Republicans gather with Republicans, Democrats gather with Democrats, and then they decide who they want to select as the nominee. And then, you know, statewide, everybody tallies up those votes, and that's who wins the Iowa caucuses. But when you go one layer deeper, there are some strategies because of the rules and the way that these things are set up. There are some strategies differing on both sides that help certain candidates win delegates, who are these party members who go on to state or county and then state conventions. The delegates are the ones who end up at the national convention and actually officially choose the nominee. And so there's a little bit of some gamesmanship that happens at these local county, at these local caucuses. And so I decided I'd go in and look and see what those strategies might be.
Excellent. All right, so give a couple of examples.
So on the Democratic side, let's start with, they have, it gets a little bit complicated, but they have what they call the viability test. So everybody gets up from their seat and they say, this year they'll say, Hillary Clinton supporters, you go stand in that corner. And Bernie Sanders supporters, you go stand in this corner. Martin O'Malley supporters, you go stand in this corner. And then there's always this corner for undecided. In 2 years, actually, fun trivia, undecided was bigger than any of the candidates in the race. This was back in the 70s. There were two elections where undecided won. But what they do then is that there's these mathematical formulas, and they calculate and they figure out what the viability threshold is for that caucus. Most of them, it's around 15%. And if you don't get 15% of the voters there, then your supporters have to realign. And so say, Martin O'Malley's folks in some precincts don't meet the viability threshold. They have to, they get to go back, and they're basically free agents, and there's this bidding war that happens over some of these. A lot of it is ideological persuasion. Why is your candidate closest to my candidate?
Oh, wow.
So they'll be talking that way. But some of it is some bartering. There are people that I talked to for the story who said, yeah, I've traded spots to delegate spots to the county convention in exchange for voters. So saying, say the Clinton people might say to O'Malley, well, we'll send two O'Malley supporters to the county caucuses as delegates if you swing your votes to us on caucus night.
For example, let's say you and I are in the same room and we go to different corners, right, to support different candidates. I could yell over to you and be like, Steve, are you nuts? You know, come to this side. Like, it could work like that?
You can. There was one woman that I spoke to who said that she was offered a bottle of wine, a very expensive bottle of wine, as a gesture. They weren't bribing. It was a gesture saying, we really think you should vote for us. Here's a bottle. There was another woman that I spoke to who said that the food was a persuasion sort of tool that's used, that some people will bake goods and they'll get hot chocolate or coffee, and they'll set it up on their side of the room, and anybody can have it. but it makes their side of the room look more welcoming, and people are coming over there, and when they come over there, they chat with them and say who he's supporting and why, and they try to persuade them as it goes. And so these are little tricks of the trade for these local precincts.
Wow.
On the Republican side, it's a little more complicated, especially this year. Their meetings are run by Robert's Rules of Order, which is the kind of rules by which all these meetings, professional meetings, business meetings, political meetings, are all kind of run. You've heard it. It's the, can I get a second, make a motion, point of order, that kind of stuff.
Jeez. Speaking with Steve Yacino, reporter at Bloomberg. I feel like I've covered elections, for a number of cycles at this point. I feel like every time I discuss Iowa, of course, I've never seen it or witnessed it, I learn something new about these caucuses. They're so unique.
Yeah, and to be fair, like, the average voter doesn't think about all of this, but campaigns do, and they're doing everything they can. Nobody's willing to take anything, to risk anything on these sites. It's so important. And it's fun to talk about, but don't ever underestimate the power of winning these caucuses, the momentum that you get just from the headlines of it. There's all this gamesmanship that does happen, that can and does happen behind the scenes. But in the end of the day, who wins the caucus gets the big bump. It's just, this stuff matters a little bit more in cases like 2008, where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were having these superdelegate fights, and you're counting delegates in every nook and cranny of the Democratic Party. They matter a little bit more, like I said, in the case of the Republicans, in the rare case that it goes to a contested convention. So, if you're a campaign this early on in the process, why take the chance?
Thanks, Steve. Steve Yacino, Bloomberg reporter. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Well, in case it didn't make it on your calendar, this is National Drug and Alcohol Facts Week. It's designed to help teenagers, their parents, and their communities learn to talk about the dangers. We're joined now by Dr. Wilson Compton. He's deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Doctor, start with some myths.
Well, there are a lot of myths out there. One of them, and a key one that I get all the time, is the idea that marijuana isn't addictive. People will say things like, marijuana is not addictive, is it? And unfortunately, that's completely untrue. It has addiction is one of the complications of using marijuana, particularly those that use heavily, regularly, and those that start during their early teen years are much more susceptible to organizing their lives around marijuana and really developing a habit to it, which is the hallmark of addiction.
Well, what's another myth that maybe teens or parents subscribe to?
Well, some of the myths are that e-cigarettes are harmless recreational substances. The issue around e-cigarettes is that some teenagers are really taking these up in remarkably large numbers. So we see more kids using e-cigarettes than regular tobacco products. And yet once they start with these e-cigarettes, there's now some new research to suggest that a significant number will go on to developing a regular smoked tobacco habit, which we know is a lifelong, a very destructive pattern of behavior.
Wow. All right, so are e-cigarettes the hot thing right now, or is there something else in there too?
Well, certainly e-cigarettes are a major concern, and part of the issue is we don't even know what's in them. So that the manufacturers don't have to tell us what they're putting in their products. We know that they contain nicotine and a vapor agent like glycerin, but they also contain flavorings and may contain other ingredients that could be quite risky. So we need to learn more about them and understand the patterns of use. That's one issue. Another major issue relates to the prescription pills and how many people are both using them and then, unfortunately, how many people across the country are dying from overdoses related to the prescription pills, especially the prescription pain relievers.
We're speaking with Dr. Wilson Compton, deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We're talking about National Drug and Alcohol Facts Week. Yeah, where's this coming from, by the way? I know that, and heroin, I mean, the stories are terrifying. Where has that come from?
Well, it started out for a very good reason. We wanted to do a better job of helping people function better that suffer from serious pain. And what happened was physicians started prescribing more and more of these pain relievers in an attempt to treat pain. Pain relievers are pretty good short term, but it turns out they don't work very well over the long run. And so we need to be thinking about other approaches to treating pain instead of simply flooding the public with opioids so that they're in lots of medicine cabinets, so they can be diverted, taken by others, shared with family and friends. And that's where you really begin to see the major problems with them.
All right. So for parents who are spooked now, having heard this conversation between you and me, how do they begin the conversation with the teen in their house if they haven't had the talk yet?
Well, I think it's kind of remarkable. Parents think that they have no influence over their teen behavior, and that really couldn't be further from the truth. Even when a teenager is rolling their eyes, not paying attention, the words and the behavior of their parents is sinking in. So there are programs like the Strengthening Families 10 to 14, which is a short-term after-school program that can help provide information for parents about how to provide both a healthy, loving, nurturing environment. That, after all, is a key to healthy development, as well as providing guidelines and limits on teenager behavior. That's sort of the dual challenges, isn't it, for all parents? How do you provide the right guidelines and limits, as well as providing a love and support?
Dr. Wilson Compton, Deputy Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. As you probably know, pro football is returning to Los Angeles now that owners have approved the relocation of the Rams from St. Louis. Part of the plan in Southern California involves a new stadium project that promises to enhance the economy and property values of the region. Can those promises be fulfilled? One guy looking into it is David Widener, managing editor of the Housing Economics Research Team at the real estate site Trulia. David, what have you found?
Well, there's 31 different markets, and there's probably 32 different stories to tell. But I can say this. If you live near an NFL stadium, it is likely that your home is worth more than it is than the average home in the metropolitan area you live. So if you live near an NFL stadium, your home is probably worth more. But if your home, if you're planning on moving into a place or a NFL stadium is moving to your neighborhood, don't get your hopes up, because over the last 10 years, NFL stadium construction has not done much to lift the fortunes of the neighborhoods that they of their new neighborhoods. So, kind of a mixed story. In general, better to live near one because you have a more valuable home. You're paying a little more rent. But of course, there are new stadiums going to be built over the next 5 to 10 years. I wouldn't make any investments, buy up all the land around these stadiums, because the more recent history is they haven't done much.
Interesting. Is there a rhyme or reason for a particular city or stadium as to why values might be up or down?
Very difficult to say, Gordon. I mean, it looks like it's case-by-case basis, but stadiums seem to do very well. There was a sweet spot of building that seems to have paid off really well, and it may have something to do with time frame. So more, I mentioned that the last 10 years, the stadiums built, say, in Phoenix and Indianapolis and Dallas, those haven't seemed to move the needle much. But if you go back another 10 years where there was a real building boom for NFL teams, those stadiums are the ones that populate the neighborhoods around those stadiums are the ones that populate the more expensive neighborhoods. So that may have a little bit of a function of where they're being built and the stadium itself. So you're looking at places like Lincoln Field in Philadelphia, NRG Stadium in Houston, Ford Field in Detroit. All those stadiums, the real estate around them now is worth considerably more than the cities in general where they reside.
We're speaking with David Widener. He's the managing editor for the Housing Economics Research Team at Trulia. He's got an interesting look at NFL stadiums and poses the question, does an NFL stadium boost your home's value? What else jumped out at you here?
Well, I think especially in light of the relocation issue that's come up recently. Of course, the NFL voting last week, 30-2, to move the St. Louis Rams to L.A. That was the thing, I think, that really got us thinking about it and what they would do to St. Louis and what it would do to Inglewood, California, where a stadium really sort of like the biggest the NFL has really ever gone for is going to be built. And that's going to, I think, have a pretty significant effect. In California, that new stadium is going into a region, into an area where home prices lag by almost 9%. The greater LA area, and it's a place that could use a little economic development. So the idea of bringing a stadium and theater and everything that this project promises, I even spoke with some real estate agents out there. There's a lot of hope around that. Now, whether or not that pans out, that we'll see. And I think on the flip side, in St. Louis, there's going to be some there's a downside. There's a potential downside because the Edward Jones Dome in downtown St. Louis was the neighborhood around there. Home prices were actually higher than they were in the metro area. So there's some potential loss that could happen there.
Thanks, David. David Widener from the real estate site Trulia. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
You appreciate the feeling of a clean, smooth shave from a quality blade. So why are you messing around with generic razors that cost $32 for an 8-pack when you can shave with Harry's high-quality German-engineered blades for half the price? Harry's will give you their starter set, complete with a razor, three of their world-famous blades, and shaving cream for just $15. And shipping is always free. We'll also give you $5 off your first order. So go to harrys.com right now and enter code 8866 at checkout. Code 8866.
Well, there's some revealing work being done by about 15 students at Emory University in Atlanta. They investigate murders from the Jim Crow era in a class called the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Kashenka.
A tragedy and a mystery some 60 years plus in the making has been solved by a group of undergrads at Emory University. They discovered the missing gravestone of a 28-year-old black man who was shot in Georgia by two white men in 1948. With more on the story is Cameron McWhorter of the Wall Street Journal. Cameron, what were these students investigating?
Well, this is an interesting class at Emory University near Atlanta. There are several universities around the country that have classes or projects that focus on finding, exploring and investigating old civil rights case murders. So murders from Jim Crow, the Jim Crow era in the South. And there were students, these students were looking into a particular case that occurred in South Georgia in 1948.
What kinds of investigative devices did they use? What kind of documents did they find?
Well, they found a bunch of FBI files that had not been recovered before that probed what actually happened in this shooting that took place, where a man named Isaiah Dixon, a farmer, had just voted, a black farmer in a small town near Mount Vernon, Georgia, had just voted in a primary election, which was the first election that was not segregated. And two white men approached him and, according to witnesses, threatened him not to vote again. And when he resisted, they shot him.
What did they find? What did they really think happened there?
They think that it's as simple as that he had resisted their threats. They were going to take him off and sort of beat him and threaten him, and he refused to do that, and then they shot him to death for voting. And those two men were charged with a crime. They were acquitted by an all-white jury, and these students have investigated, found that basically he should have been, these men were murdered him because of his voting record, not because of the fact that he voted, not because of any other reason. And they had argued self-defense, which didn't really seem to hold up considering the facts.
What did the victim's family think about all this?
Well, they have been traumatized by this for decades, as you can imagine. The family, after the shooting, had fled to Jacksonville, Florida, and the cause had been taken up by the NAACP and others for several years, but then dropped because nothing happened. The men were acquitted, and they just continued on with their lives. Over time, the family, particularly a young woman who's 73 now, but who was a six-year-old girl when this happened, she had visited back visited the town several times with her family, but over time the family just didn't return, and she lost track of her father's grave, and she really didn't know anything about these FBI files or anything that pretty much exonerates her father from that this was any kind of self-defense act by these white men, and that they were really threatening him because of he was voting. So the students just uncovered all this. They spent months researching all this, and that's what this class does. They take a particular case and sort of find as much data and much documentation from court records, from federal government records, anything they can to try to piece together what actually happened.
Cameron, do you know how they actually found the physical gravesite?
That was just a whim. That was just accident. They were several students were at the courthouse in this Montgomery County, Georgia, and they decided to go see where they thought the grave of Isaiah Nixon might be. They knew it was in a country that was probably in a country graveyard outside of town. So they drove out there and were just walking around. And one young woman, Ellie Stoddard, She told me last week that she, as a young girl, her father used to take her grave rubbing, you know, to rub gravestones. And so she was just putzing around in the graveyard, and she saw in a very, you know, edge of the graveyard where the forest had sort of started to grow back in, she saw a little gravestone. She saw three letters. She brushed it aside, and then she realized she'd found his grave. And so she quickly called everyone over. And so last Friday, Dorothy Nixon Williams, who is now 73 years old, and saw her father get shot, fatally shot in 1948, was able to see her father's grave for the first time.
How about that? Wow, this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhorter, who's based in Atlanta. 20 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. The number of people trying to buy food labeled as natural is on the rise, but that doesn't mean we actually understand what we're buying from the grocery store. Business reporter Hadley Malcolm at USA Today calls it a confused consumer epidemic. Hadley, how so?
Percentage of people looking for natural food has grown, yet when they ask people what they think the label means, most people give it attributes that it doesn't actually have, because the thing is that label is not regulated at all.
So there's a broad definition then of what some food companies think natural means.
Right. So the deal is the FDA doesn't legally, you know, officially define the term. It's not bound by any sort of law. They have a kind of a policy that they go by in terms of what they, you know, how they interpret it, but it's not, the use of that word is not regulated by any law in particular.
Right. We're speaking with Hadley Malcolm, business reporter at USA Today. Her piece is called "More Shoppers Buying, Quote, Natural Food, Yet Most Don't Know What It Means." All right. So when I see these labels, I tend to think, okay, it's natural. That means it probably won't be blamed for my death tonight. Like, it could have long-term problems, or another product may have long-term problems. This one, maybe not so much.
Well, that's the interesting thing is we look, so, I spoke to a behavioral economist, a professor of behavioral economics, rather, and who said, you know, we look for these little cues, right? We zero in on health claims, and we think, oh, that means that it's good for me, that means that I won't gain weight, or that means that I will feel better after I eat it, but when in reality, we're just kind of putting those thoughts on the food. It doesn't mean that any of those things are true.
Yeah. Does the food industry think that the FDA might at some point try to specifically define the word natural?
It's something that they're looking into right now. There is an open public comment period going on right now where anyone can go onto the FDA site and basically tell them what they think about natural food labels.
Right.
It's something that some organizations like Consumer Reports, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, have been pushing for in recent years to get this term defined. No one can really say at this point whether the FDA will do anything about it.
All right. Thanks, Hadley. Hadley Malcolm, business reporter at USA Today. 13 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. Olivia Newton-John in those tight black pants, though. Here's something for your Sunday night TV viewing. Fox is trying to build on the success of NBC's live musicals by broadcasting Grease Live. Wall Street Journal arts reporter Pia Catton says, in contrast with those shows, Grease is pushing the concept by adding a live audience stationed throughout locations on the set within sight of TV viewers. Pia, what will it be like?
What the television audience will see is not only the actors taking place and singing, you know, these lovable kind of high school cliques at Rideau High, right? But you will also see parts of the audience which will be seated within the set so that you can see their reactions and see them kind of interact a little bit with the stars.
Whoa, meaning what? What are they going to do?
Well, they will be kind of walking by. You can wave, the watchers, the audience can wave. They can be cheering during the pep rally, which is a little bit of a step forward, really. When you watch a television show that is broadcast with a live audience, you can hear them very often. You can hear their laughter, but you can't always see them. You know, sometimes at Saturday Night Live, the camera will pan over the live studio audience, but that's about it.
All right, so if I'm there, I can be on my cell phone, like you see people at a baseball game, like at the right moment, or a football game.
I wonder about that.
Right?
I would like to know. I've heard they will not be in costume, so you won't have to dress up like you're in 1958 just to be on the show.
What else will be notable about this broadcast?
Well, I think you will see some theater stage techniques for moving around the sets. So, you know, you don't usually see kind of a curtain drop or walls open up when you're watching a movie or a television show, but you do see that in theater. And in theater, we're okay with that. That's just how it happens. You only have 10 feet, right, or however many feet you have on stage. But I think you will see a little bit of that. Also, it sounds to me like the race car scene, which is going to take place at night, it will use a lot of film techniques with some lighting that will kind of look like street lamps moving by faster and faster and faster. There will be kind of remote control cars. I'm really looking forward to seeing the race car scene. It was described to me in detail, but you know, it's hard to visualize it.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Pia Catton. Her piece is called Grease is the Word for a New Kind of Live TV Audience Experiences this weekend on Fox. I know we've done like a couple of, or seen a couple of broadcasts now, right, of theater live. Is this...
Yes.
How might this one be different, I guess? Is Fox trying to set a new trend here?
I do think that the previous live broadcasts have had a little bit of a lag when there's been a joke and there's no laughter on the in the broadcast. You know, if you're sitting there watching with friends, your friends will laugh, but when you see a joke land on television, there's no laugh track and there's no live audience, you think, maybe it wasn't as funny as I thought it was. So with the live audience sitting right there laughing. And, of course, if you remember Grease, it is really funny. There's a lot of jokes. There's a lot of silliness. It's high school teenagers, right? I think you are going to have a lot of feedback from the audience. I think that will be the main difference.
You mentioned these quick set changes in something like the Grease lightning scene, for example.
Right. Again, the car, I think, is going to be really interesting. So in that scene, if you remember, they have in the movie, they have kind of an old car, and they're imagining what it would be like if it, you know, was this really hot rod, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in this, from what I'm told, they kind of piece together a new super-looking car right in front of you.
So cool. Thanks, Pia. Wall Street Journal arts reporter Pia Catton. Glad you're with us. You know, making the NFL Pro Bowl is almost as easy as qualifying for the NHL playoffs these days. The Wall Street Journal says, so far, a record high 131 players have been selected, which is being played Sunday in Hawaii. How about this? Given that there were 1,973 players who appeared in at least one NFL game this past season, a whopping 6.6% of them have ended up as All-Stars. The NBA invites 5.7%, baseball 5.6%, hockey is the stingiest at 5%. So what's up with football generosity? One big reason, only 86 players were originally selected this year, but due to things like injuries, a lot of replacement players were needed. For example, Minnesota Vikings quarterback Teddy Bridgewater ranked 22nd in the NFL in passing yards this season. He finished 26th in touchdown passes and wound up 22nd in quarterback rating. In most years, those numbers would make for a fairly mediocre season. This year, they made Bridgewater an all-star. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.